Hi everyone, welcome back to my channel. My name is Stassi. Thank you so much for being here today. Happy Monday, everybody. I know you're getting on my break. You're getting three podcasts this month, but I'm so excited about this one. I cannot wait to dive in and what it's like and how to become a youth author. And I have Morgan Owens here today. So thank you so much for coming here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Oh my God, thank you so much for wanting to be here. I'll give a little context to how we got to this moment. Let's take a story flashback here. As I said when we were before our chat, I was Instagram stalking you. As please listen to everybody who's listening to this. I actually do that quite frequently. I'm always trying to find the next best simmer to interview or how to take a page to the next level. And yours came across my Instagram feed, and I was like, oh cool, I'm just gonna star this because I flag all the pages for later or save like one screenshot so I can be like, when I'm going to book guests for season three, I can go back and do that. You ended up following me because I interviewed Angel. Then I was like, the name sound familiar because I literally go by display picture and your content. The names are amazing, but there's so many fantastic names out there that I will get mashed up. So I messaged you right away and I was like, you are living my dream of being a youth author. How do you do this? And I was expecting to be left on, not left on read, but like not answered that quickly. I'm literally driving home. You write me the most perfect message on how to do this. And I was like, I gotta interview you. How to become a youth writer. And then to double down even further on it is last week, me and Starzy Simsy sat down and talked about how to become a sim storyteller. And so many amazing simmers out there who haven't started their sim story have reached out to me saying, how do I start? How do I become a writer? And all this stuff. And I was like, well, I'm literally interviewing a writer Sunday. Like let's do this. So thank you, Morgan, for being here today. Before we dive in and you can give us all the tips and tricks, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Oh, that's always a difficult question, isn't it?
Isn't
Who
it?
am I? I'm Morgan. I am British. I have been a writer for as long as I can remember, but didn't get paid for it in a sort of professional capacity until I got my first book deal a few years ago. Before then, I worked in, well, I've sold gas and electricity door to door. I have worked in clothes shops. I worked in phone shops. I worked at call centers. I worked in film PR in London for a little bit. That was a little bit more interesting. Did some editorial work. I did go to university, but I dropped out, so I don't actually have a degree. So that's just to say you can get into writing and you can be published without this like formal background. Yeah, I love The Sims, obviously, play The Sims a lot. Have two cats. I love travel. I was supposed to go to Japan when the pandemic happened and it got cancelled, so I'd love to do that again. I am neurodivergent. I don't know, not very good at talking about myself, but hopefully through the course of this chat, you could learn a little bit more about me maybe. Oh, I love coffee. I make my own coffees twice a day. Grinding the beans and everything. Yeah, let's see what we can drag out of me when we're just talking about writing, and I'll just try and sprinkle in some bits here and there.
I love that. I feel like ha liking coffee and a writer truly does go hand in hand. What is your favorite coffee to make?
Oh, caramel mac, like
Okay.
a Starbucks style caramel, like macchiato, which is not the same as like a traditional Italian style macchiato. So it's got a lot of syrup in it, and I froth the milk, and it's just delicious. It's just that little cup of heaven. Probably shouldn't have two a day, to be honest. It's probably not good for you or the caffeine, but that's my routine now. So
Hey, I
yeah.
mean, you shouldn't like, it's like you shouldn't have more than a teaspoon of sugar a day. You shouldn't have more than a fistful of meat in like every 2 days. Like I think the thing is like whatever works for you works for you, and if you're happy, you're happy, and that, yeah. And that's how I look at it.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive in. So you said you started writing stories for as long as you can remember. Do you remember what your first story was?
It was about like a Sylvanian family. So, you know, Sylvanian, what were they called in America? I don't know whether you got them as Sylvanian families, calico critters. You know those little toy.
Oh, yeah, calico cricket. Yeah. I love those. They're so cute.
Yeah, I have some. I collected them as a kid. I still have some. I wrote about a family of cat-headed critters. I'm afraid I can't remember the plot now, but I do remember that my primary school, as like the elementary school teacher, read it for some reason and invited me to his office and told me how good it was. So I think that was the moment where I was like, oh, all right, I'm gonna do this then. You know, kids are like, oh, I'm good at this. Like, you got so much confidence when you're a kid. So yeah, I think it was about a cat family. It was probably just about their trials and tribulations, their daily life. And then later, by the time I was a teenager, I was definitely writing stories about, you know, I read a book that was about having a crush on your brother's best friend. And so I like copied that storyline and wrote my own, you know, before you kind of come up with your own ideas. But I was always like playing pretend. So I was like writing stories without writing them down forever.
I love that. So I'm assuming you were into fan fiction then.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not like huge into Potter anymore, more so JK Rowling. She's kind of problematic, to be honest, but I was a big Potterhead and did write some really random fanfic. I remember I was obsessed with The Nanny, you know,
TV show. I do know The Nanny, yes.
And Drescher. I wrote like The Nanny fanfic. I don't think that made it onto the internet, thankfully. But yeah, like I was definitely soaking up the inspiration of whatever I was into at that moment, a TV show, a film, whatever. And that was what I would write about. And I would just make things up just all the time, just by myself.
Since Harry Potter is the best fan fiction you'll ever read in your life, next to Sailor Moon, because that's literally how like all the fan fiction I read as a small child was Sailor Moon. What was your story for fanfic for Harry Potter?
I had a couple. I think I had a young Snape one. Please don't judge me too harshly. I think I had some Draco. I was like into that dark, you know, Slytherin kind of vibes, and exploring like the darker characters. I don't really remember. I had a gender swapped one. There was like a girl Harry Potter.
Okay.
I ever made it online. Yeah, I think I was literally rewriting the story, but with a girl version. I think she was called Harriet. Really, really original. Harriet Potter. I'm sure there's a lot of them out there now. But this was in the day before there was like a, I think there was like one, there was like a Harry Potter fanfic site that I used to go on. I can't remember what it's called, but it wasn't like AO3. Like there wasn't like this big central, or at least I wasn't aware of it then.
I love yeah. that. Could you imagine if Harry and Ron were girls and Hermione was a boy?
Yeah, that was amazing.
And like how much the story would be different.
Ron was a great girl. I remember that. Like Ron was like just really fun to write as a girl. Just
yes. Because,
like the comedy kind of relief, and it's more often a boy who plays that role. And just like he's bloody hell, it's just it was quite like a vivid, you know, different because Harry, I don't want to diss Harry, but Harry's quite like the straight man character.
Yes.
You know, like you swap the genders and it's just Hermione, totally different vibe as a boy, kind of annoying, you know, like mansplaining yes. to everyone. Yeah,
yes. Oh. And Ron would just be the girl class clown that everybody had went to school with that was just always having fun, always never taking life seriously.
At the same time, like, oh, life's really hard for me sometimes. Yeah, I could get really into it. But that was a long time ago. I can't tell you any more details than that. And I don't remember what happened. It probably was not structurally sound.
but that's like the beauty of like creative writing. Was
Babysitter's Club. Sorry.
Oh my god, Babysitter's Club. I was a Nancy Drew girl making my own mysteries. I was always the hero in any story I wrote, being like, I can solve anything. I can do everything. I love that. So
if we can't make ourselves the heroes.
Exactly. So you were in a fanfic, you wrote fanfic. When did the girl with no soul, how did that concept come to you?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so years ago, I'm trying to think how many years. It was before 2016. I can say that for sure. Let's say like a couple of years before 2016. This, because 2016 is like my timeline. I can easily track to what I was doing and thinking and feeling around, because there are a lot of momentous events happening. I basically put a tweet out. It started with a tweet. And the tweet was something like, what if like when you're born, you have to find your soul. You don't have it like innately within you. You have to go through life kind of collecting bits of your soul like treasure. And you find one in a book. You find one in a song. You find one in a piece of art. And it did quite well as a tweet. I probably worded it way better than that. And it was just like how you find yourself as an adult, actually, and how, like, you know, the idea of the soul is like something we're born with, if you believe in a soul. Mm-hmm. But instead, it's something that actually in practice you kind of accumulate through your life. And, you know, and you find like that song, that book that speaks to you on this deep, deep level, that it actually shapes who you are a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was just that idea. And I had an agent already at that time. I'll track back to that. My agent loved that and was like, please write this. And then years and years and years passed. And I started writing at some point. And then at another point, I was like, I don't like this, trash it. It's awful. And my agent was like, no, I'm going to send this to somebody who I think will really like it. And that is how it happened. So this was a book that I was trying to, it wasn't finished at the point where I sold it, and I was actually trying to get rid of it because I didn't, you don't always like have a good perspective on your own writing, where it would sit in the market or an idea. So yeah, this kind of happened despite me. And so I know obviously a lot of writers work really hard and they fight and fight and fight to be seen and to get their work, you know, kind of even considered. But publishing is a really diverse market and people get book deals in all kinds of ways. So it can come from something like that. But yeah, persistence, I guess, is the thing that gets you to the finish line.
Amazing. And you said you already had an agent. So like myself and several other amazing storytellers out there that want to get an agent, how do you find an agent? And how how does the pay structure work?
So your agent generally does not get paid until you sell a project.
Okay.
So then they take a cut. So basically my agent I was with for a really long time, like nearly a decade before I sold a book. So the amount of work she will do is sort of dependent on how active you are as a writer, but she kind of stuck around and nurtured me. I guess when I was quietly working on things, I wasn't taking up any of her time or too much money. And she had this idea that at some point it would pay off and that I would sell a project in. And I actually knew her because I had a project years and years ago, and she was hired as an editor to look at that project. So she edited it. She used to do some editing work as well. And she fell in love with that story. And so when she was done, she was like, I'm transitioning to be an agent as well as an editor. This was really early on in her career. So that was key, is that sometimes as a young like or a developing writer, you can sometimes form a connection with a agent who's also just starting out in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
That can be way more productive and easier connections to form than if you are approaching someone who's already at the top of their career. They're probably getting offers left, right, center. And the key thing I would love to like impart in this podcast is that your success in publishing, it isn't all about whether you're good or not. It's about what the market's looking for. Mm-hmm. And so the agent is really key in that respect, because they have relationships with editors at publishing houses. So they have that door open, but they also are aware of trends that are going on, which is not to say that people don't sell projects that are completely new trends, off trend, you know, but yeah, that these things have an effect on how easy it is to get published. But yeah, so if you're just starting out, it's just as valuable to, excuse me, say, get on Twitter and become part of the Twitter writing community there, because you might attract the attention of an agent during a pitch event. They do regular pitch events where you pitch your story idea and maybe a mood board, and agents look at them, and if they're interested, they like, and they ask for a copy of that. That's the easiest way sometimes to get an agent. But also, yeah, you will get to know who is who in the industry a little bit and what they're looking for. And agents will literally put out tweets saying, I'm looking for a client who has a middle grade fantasy, who has a young adult romance that they want to sell in. And that's your easiest way in the door. Is so I always tell people to get, I know Twitter, oh, it's awful, but the writing community is not that bad.
I love that. So it's kind of like the Sims community. It's a very niche community. Once you're in, you're in. Like, what hashtags, what pages, who do you have to follow to get into the Twitter writing community?
I mean, it's going to be a little bit different for me because a lot of the people I follow are UK based.
Okay.
Assuming that people will be watching from the US and Canada or lots of different places. So I don't know these specific names, maybe in your country. I think the easiest thing would be to Google writing like pitch events, because they are also sometimes UK, US based.
Yeah.
Or, okay, the easiest way, sign up for a Twitter account, follow your favorite writers, look on your bookshelf and look at all of those writers that you want to be like, whose stuff you appreciate. Follow them, look at who they follow, read their tweets. They will retweet people, including agents, editors, and other writers. Follow them all, follow anyone who's in the genre you hope to write in. And literally you could go through and just do that in a couple of hours and you'd end up following like hundreds of people. And that would be your best start, would be to sit back, see what they're all talking about. And then you're literally within a week or so, there'll be a pitch event, a specific pitch event. But there's enough of them that every time I kind of log in, there's usually something going on. And that's when I see a lot of people who have no agent, but are already part of the writing community, talking about their unpublished projects. And they're usually like, there's usually like loads of great ones. It's not a lack of talent is the problem usually for people trying to break it. It's not a lack of talent at all. It's like a lack of opportunity. And then it being, you know, there's only so many things that publishing is looking for at that given point. But if you're lucky enough to have a project that ticks those boxes, it can, people's lives change within a couple of hours. People go from being on Twitter, just, you know, trying to sell their story, maybe thinking about self-publishing. And, you know, within a weekend or something, you could actually, you could have an agent rep deal. Also, it's important to say that some people are able to get publishing deals without an agent. It's just harder. So
okay.
I have a friend who sold a book before they had an agent and then had to get an agent afterwards. So it was, like I said, like, it's kind of, it's a very diverse community and there's loads of different ways in.
Which is amazing. So after you get your agent, they, you know, they get your book to a publishing house. What kind of happens after that?
Pain.
Pain.
Stress, anxiety. Yeah. Again, it can be a really, really long wait. Some people might not hear back. I mean, the industry standard is that it's supposed to be done within a certain time, a few weeks, a few months, depending on what's agreed. But that's not the case all the time. Some people send over, say your agent sends over a project to an editor that they've already told them about the idea. And they already know that that editor's kind of open to it. Maybe that's what they're looking for. You could maybe have an offer of interest. I mean, I've heard same day. Hours later, that's like big time crazy town stuff. Otherwise, it could be a couple of weeks, a couple of months when they get around to reading it. But still pretty quick turnover if you've spent years and years of your life wanting to be a writer and you've gotten to that point of like, I'm gonna go out and research and do this, and I'm doing all these things for myself, you know, that can feel like a really fast turnover to get in an offer. So yeah, your agent will usually tell you who they're going to send it to and send you a list of the editors that they are targeting. And that can be really broad, like they can send out to loads and loads of people. So you've got the numbers game. One of them, hopefully, yay, will ask for a full and read the, because you usually send just like partial, like maybe three chapters or one chapter. Or they already have a specific editor in mind, as I said, and that can be a much quicker process. But that depends on them having a good relationship. And that's where the agent comes in, because we generally don't have that like direct relationships with editors other than, say, on social media.
Okay. Amazing. So
maybe that's like, is that, tell me to slow down if this is like too much information.
No, no. I think anybody listening to this is kind of like, huh, this is how it's done. Okay. So you've gone to your editor. They're like, we fucking love this. We want to sign you three books and a movie kind of idea. So what happens after? So you're presented an offer, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And is that... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's how it goes.
Okay. So you get an offer, and do you then have to... So say if the book's not written, do you have, say, we want a finished... a book, say 6 months from today, and you have to make that happen. Can that happen? Yeah. Okay.
That absolutely can and does happen all the time. Especially to writers who have already got some books out. They will perhaps be like, because you've got this proven product, I suppose. So they're like, okay, you did it once, you can do it again. You could do it in a shorter time. Mm-hmm. You could do it like, generally, always the book will be extensively outlined, at least, and almost always between one to three chapters minimum. If you're a huge mega mega writer, you probably don't have to do any of those things. They probably will just make you an offer based on a pitch, but that's if you've got a really proven background. This does happen to debuts sometimes, so it's not like just something that happens to people who are already established. If I always say people, yes, it matters that your book is really well written and plotted, and, or, you know, of course that matters. It matters to the reader, but it also matters how easily this idea can be pitched to people who have never heard it before, and how enticing you can make that little package sound. If your story is really quite complicated, and even when trying to explain it to your friends, you find just it's like a long oh well, it's about this girl and she does this and does that. No, not good enough. You need like a hook, one line concept, ideally. It's not like, obviously literature is really broad and some literature defies explanation completely, and stories get sold that are really random and surreal all the time, but for the most part, commercial fiction, where it's at now, you need to have like a hooky pitch for your story that is just a little unique kind of descriptor that has something in it that is gonna, you could share it with anyone and they'd be like, huh, I don't think I've heard of something quite like that before. Obviously, a lot of stories have a lot of similarities. It's just about finding that one little thing and how you can phrase it in a way that's really packageable. That helps a lot. But yeah, so you get your offer and you will discuss with your agent. Sometimes you might have multiple offers. If your book went out to multiple publishers at once, and then you have like an auction situation where they all battle it out, and that's where people make the crazy, crazy money, because in that moment the publisher's like, we need this, it's gonna be huge, it's gonna be a bestseller, and so they fight it out, and whoever offers the most money usually wins. But sometimes the author will pick whoever has the best vision for their story. That's when, this has not happened to me, but this is when you're really, you know, living it up. What to say, that's like the author dream, I suppose, to have all these publishers fighting it out. But it can also be really stressful, because then the pressure is on you massively right from the beginning to deliver something extraordinary. So in my experience, it can sometimes be better for your first book deal to be a bit smaller and more manageable. You've got a chance of earning out your advance, which is the money they pay you in advance of writing the story. Yeah, that's like their little taster for you. Like, you've got to meet your deadline. Here's some money. Here's some money to entice you. So you make the decision, you accept the offer. And sometimes after that, it takes a really long time to get the contracts through. They have a whole legal department that you and your agent and the legal department will go down to the letter, to the small print, and they fight out about rights. This is where things get real complicated. But the publisher doesn't usually, they're not the ones that offer you a film deal. Mm-hmm. They might take the rights for a film adaptation from you, and that might be part of the package, or your agent might hold on to those rights and sell them to someone else who specializes in film and TV. But yeah, again, that's the dream for a lot of writers, because that's where there's also big money, and they pay you to take the project off your hands. And then even if it doesn't get made, you still get that money, which happens a lot. So it gets optioned for TV and film. You get paid, you get to enjoy that money. It might never, ever... That's something to warn writers about, because you could get really excited, like, oh my god, they're gonna make a movie out of my project, and then it never happens. But you get paid either way, which is
amazing. That's absolutely incredible. Thank you for sharing that. So you obviously got a deal with Scholastic. What was that moment like when they reached out to you, or sorry, when your agent told you that that was the publishing house that wanted to take your project on?
Disbelief. And like, not everyone will feel this way, but me personally, I was like, oh, you know, I didn't really feel like worthy of it, to be honest, like self-esteem wise. Not every writer out there is really confident in their abilities, which is why so many people never share their work, and it's just sitting on their computer, and it could be an absolute masterpiece and no one would ever know. So I personally was exactly the kind of writer who needed someone to push me a little bit, or I wouldn't have done anything with it. I just entertained myself for years and years. So I had like a video call with a couple of people from Scholastic, and I remember at the end of the call being like, thanks so much, it's an honor just to talk to you and just to be considered. Because in my head I was like, this is not gonna happen, this is too good to be true. I just didn't really like believe that it would really happen. It's hard to put into words, but it was, you know, when you get something presented to you in life and you're just like suspicious of it, almost like, I don't know, like, I don't want to get my heart broken, so I'm gonna hold a little piece of myself back. I years ago had gone down this road before. I wrote a novel over 10 years ago, I think. It got looked at by a couple of the big five publishers, and it got considered in-house. They had fulls, so they had the full manuscript that time, and in the end they passed, and like it kind of devastated me a little bit, and so I just went away and like wrote for myself for a long time. So I knew how this journey can go, so I was protecting myself a little bit. And then I got a call from my agent, and I'm the kind of person who in the moment I'm like, I can't, I'm like kind of numb, you know, like I'm just like disbelieving. And then afterwards I was in the garden with my family, and I was kind of shaking and crying. And that night I went to see two of my best friends who knew nothing, had not breathed a word about any of this, which is like common, because if you tell people about it and then it doesn't happen, that can be hard to like process.
Mm-hmm.
So I got out of the, I think I got a cab, I got out of the cab and I walked up to them, and they're in the garden. It was sunny, it was the summer. And I just started like, oh my god, I'm gonna rupture. And I was like walking towards them. Like I just all came out and I just started screaming, and they were like, what? What? They couldn't believe that I hadn't said a word about this. And we were all just shrieking. It was just, yeah, it's difficult to, that's like maybe the best part of the publishing process, until you get a copy of your book. Oh, I've got to show them off, just my babies. When you get to hold those in your hands, that's like the next moment that's just really like overwhelming. But a lot of the stuff in between is quite hard and tough, and you go through some really low times as well. I wanted to talk about like the highs and lows of publishing a little bit, because you think, oh, this is my life's dream, like everything's going to be great now, and it's hard. And so there'll be, you know, there's all these other milestones on the journey, and it's very competitive in publishing, and you get added to like a group with loads of authors, and you make new author friends, but then you're all like kind of, you're not competing with each other, but the industry kind of makes you feel like you are. And so there's a lot of struggles there. So it's those moments that you have to like hold on to and remember forever, because the roller coaster will get you, get on the, yeah, you start on the roller coaster after that. Yeah, like what to say, I still feel like unworthy on some level. Like There's so many amazing writers out there who deserve this as well. And I just feel incredibly lucky. Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely amazing. So you got your book deal. They're like, we're going to make your first book. How long was it from the book deal to the day of release? Was it like 6 months, a year, a couple years?
Oh, no. I mean, so the industry standard is supposed to be like 1 year plus 1 to 2 years. This was like less than 9 months, I think. So
Okay.
that was in the summer of 2021 when I was with my friends and I told them for the first time. And the book came out March 2022.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And it, as I said, it was not fully written at that point of sale.
That's really quick. So when it comes to like all of it, so are you doing press tours? Are you doing book readings? Like, who makes the graph? Do you make the graphics? Do you shop it out? Does the publishing house make the graphics for this?
This is where it gets kind of complicated because the answer is different for every single writer.
Okay.
The bigger advance you get paid, the bigger they expect your book to be. The more money gets put into your book's promotionals in-house.
Okay.
I'd say the vast majority of authors get very little promotions that can be perceived as things are going on behind the scenes, but you don't get to see any of that. A lot of the time, if you're on Twitter or whatever, following authors, they make their own graphics. I make my own graphics, but the one I did my announcement with was made by Scholastic. So I would say I'm like luckier than some people. I got lovely assets made for me. Scholastic does loads of promotions that are like invisible. They have networks of influencers, bookster people, booktop people. They send out the advanced copies. There's so many things that happen and they're different for everyone. I am doing like a couple of signing events, but that is more something that is like, here we have Waterstones is the main book chain, and Waterstones will approach authors depending on really varied factors and ask them to do events. It's like a rite of passage as an author, even quite big authors like Neil Gaiman, like they'll do events sometimes and no one turns up. It's like, yeah. So you have to prepare yourself a little bit because it sounds so glamorous. But I did get to do YALC, which is the Young Adult Literature Convention, got to be on a panel. I was on a panel at the Cheltenham Literature Festival as well. You get mic'd up. There were famous people in the green room. That's like when you know what I said about the roller coaster. So you have those moments, and then you have these real lows as well. So it's very rare that someone releases the book, immediately becomes a household name. It does happen, but it's rare, really rare, and stays at the top like that. Almost everyone will be up and down, up and down, up and down. And I'd say like 90% of all writers were all in this one big pool together. And then there's this 10% pool for the super, super, super successful writers. And that can happen to anyone, but it's just a smaller sector. Everyone else here, we're all trying to help each other. We're all kind of like mid-listers to leads. So yeah, it's chaotic, and there is no there's no guidelines that I can say that will apply to everyone. But we're now moving into this era where more is expected from the average author in terms of social media. You run your own podcast and you already know how much work goes into that. And so some writers are on TikTok every day creating viral content, because they've either had like the marketing budget at publisher and it's gone, they've spent through it, or they didn't ever have much to begin with. And that is the one thing that authors can really do to take it into their hands and get their book out there. But not everyone is up for that. And like, I wouldn't be able to do that. Like, I wouldn't be able to be this full-time TikTok creator and write books as well. So there's like a mixture of everyone in there. But yeah, some people will get amazing press. They'll be on TV. They have billboards. It just depends on the writer and the deal that they did in the first place. And how many translation rights deals? So my book has been translated into French, Spanish, and Italian.
Okay.
So if you get those translation deals early on before the, say, English version is published, it's like another sign of the industry that people will put more money into you.
Okay.
And that is how a lot of authors make their advance back. So the publisher buys your book. They pay you so much in advance that you now owe them. You never have to pay it back, but it's on the record as what you owe them in a more general sense. And you can then clear that debt. It's not an official debt, but you can clear that through selling your book for translation. That's like the common way that writers get into the green with their books, as we say, like earned out. Yeah.
I love that. So how did it feel for the first time to hold your book in your hand?
Like I was going to wake up. It's like really cliched, but just not like not real. This is not real life. It's not like, I mean, how would anyone feel? You think that you'll have this big, powerful emotional moment, and some people probably do, but I think a lot more people are just like, I can't comprehend this all in like this one moment. And so then you just have this, you keep looking at it, and sometimes I still actually think I'm gonna wake up one day and all this whole thing would have just been like a really long extended dream. It's surreal. And it was like emotional. I felt like I'd gone through a lot to get to that point. I'd like struggled a lot in life, and you know, it hadn't been easy to like get this far. So yeah, kind of just overwhelming, really. Still is a little bit and terrifying, to be honest. I would say that, like, it's scary. It's a scary thing.
It's scary because you're putting your baby out there, and it could work. Like, in your mind, you have the best story. The publishers back you. You're like, this is going to be amazing. It's going to be great. We're going to translate in multiple languages. It's going to be so good. And as soon as it gets into the reader's hands, they make the decision if it's good or not. Not anybody else, in my opinion, they decide, because they'll be like, oh, I read this and it was garbage. It's no different than any movie or TV show you watch, unless it's Madame Web, and we all knew that was going to be garbage. But... but it's so fascinating. When I was putting together this ad, the description for this podcast, I pulled up your Goodread for your first book, and it had over 1,000 reviews. What did that feel like to know that obviously more than 1,000 people have read it, but 1,000 people took the time out of their day to respond to this story?
Yeah, I mean, if you read some of them, you will probably see that it is a mixed bag. Like, so I've had reviews that have been like, this is one of the best books I've ever read. And I've also had reviews that were like, this is garbage. So what you said about readers do decide, but also readers are not in unison. Like, they are not, we do not have the same taste on things. If a book gets, like, you commonly see this, that if a book gets super popular, the opinions become way more diverse then.
Yes.
And so the bigger the book, so I know that a book's relatively successful when I can go on Goodreads and on the first page find some absolute like howlers like trashing it to high heaven, because it's being seen by more people, so you're gonna have that. It's not the best feeling, to be, it's quite, you're quite vulnerable. And so there is a common thing that writers tell each other: do not look on Goodreads. And writers have breakdowns, like, for real, like, because it's like that thing, you know, it's your dream.
Mm-hmm.
And you've gotten this far, you've gotten all the hard stuff over, and you think like, now is gonna be the, like, for me, in the early, all of my early reviews were really, really good, like 5 stars. And you start to think like, yay. And then you get one that they just did not vibe with it at all. And so the number one piece of advice I have for anyone who hopes to be a writer is to work on your self-esteem. Because if you believe in yourself and you believe in your project without question, you're just going to read that and think, it wasn't for them or whatever. If you are like doubting yourself and doubting your work and your ability, you're going to read that and think, they're right. And that's when you get into real trouble as a writer. Like, I will always defend people's right to leave shitty book reviews. Like, that is a reader's right. I try not to go in that space too much. I used to go on Goodreads a lot, drove myself a little crazy, not because I was reading them like, how dare they, but because I was reading negative ones, being like, yes, they're right. I should have done this. You can get yourself into a cycle there. And sometimes the great reviews, it's hard to take that on in the same way. Like, my neighbor wrote me this letter about how she hadn't read for years and how she read my book and she loved it so much and now she loved reading again. And I was like, that like brought me to tears, you know, like that was like a reminder of why we do this in the first place. But yeah, you need to come into publishing with a healthy sense of self and self-esteem, which is harder. Like, most writers are kind of neurotic and anxious, but we do our best because otherwise some of that stuff can be really hurtful. Like, yes, I respect your right to say what you want and give your real opinion, and I'm like cool with it now. I'm like, yep, this happens. But if you're having a bad day or whatever, I'd be like, just do not do not go looking like that. And so writer's advice they give each other also is to look up your favorite books on Goodreads, like the classics or whatever, and read like some of the one star reviews for your classic favorites of all time, just to remind yourself that, you know, there's a lot of different readers out there and they like a lot of different things.
Very good advice. It's all that advice also carries over to like content creating or really truly anything you put out there. It's like reading the comments, right? You take the good comments with the bad comments. There's just people that are assholes and trolls that are gonna tear you down and they don't give a shit. They're just like, ah, it's funny.
Yeah, I think people are kind of jealous as well. You know, like if like there's a lot of writers, not writers, but there's a lot of people in like the book reviewing community who write super negative reviews because they get more clicks on it. Like, it gets more interactions. And I was thinking, gosh, that's like quite cynical, isn't it? So there's that difference between real, genuine, constructive criticism that you can read as a writer and be like, you know what, I agree. I actually agree with you. And the stuff that's just designed to be kind of spiteful. And you're right, like, it's everything. It's not just about writing. Being a person online in 2024 like requires a certain steeliness, you know, a certain thick skinness, because people are mean.
They are mean.
Yeah,
And
they are. It's
it's sad. I think the pandemic kind of just ruined people of like how to talk to people because we were online, and it's that invisible wall that you'll never see that person in real life. So I can kind of say anything. But if a negative reader stood face to face with you, I don't think that they would write what they truly did say.
yeah. Or they're just like, oh, you just like see them crying and you think, oh wow, was it really important that I shared that in the, I mean, that's just the way of things. Like, I want to make a distinction between like people's right to one star books or whatever. Respectfully share your opinion, all good. But yeah, like there is that we are meaner for interactions, better engagement on the mean reviews and stuff. And yeah, just like, yeah, I don't know if it's because the world is getting harsher as well, so everyone else, we get harsher with each other, and it's a little bit of that on the internet.
Cannot agree more. Well, something that's not harsh. You were able to produce not one book, but your second book is coming out on May 9th. Talk to me the process of making a sequel. Did Scholastic come to you say we want a sequel, or did you go to them saying I have a sequel in mind?
So it was a two book deal that I did originally with them,
Okay.
and in the contract, it's number one, The Girl with No Soul, which had a different title actually back when the contract was signed. That happens also. The publisher will definitely have a heavy hand on the title because they are coming up from a marketing point of view.
What was the original title?
I think they were right. It was Phantasmagoria.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, every writer and story of their name is phenomenal, but the girl with no soul, I would pick that up being like, how does she not have a soul? And everybody has a soul.
They were completely right about that. So yeah, two book deal. The second book was TBC. And it was originally like, oh, we'll talk about it between us. And I pitched them some other ideas. I sent them, I think, five ideas, and two were in the same universe. Three were new projects. And then this is a bit tricky. So I finished The Girl with No Soul, not knowing if there would be a sequel or not. So I had to end it in a way that was satisfying as a one-off. After that point, I then was told it had sold to the French at that point before it had come out. So the French had bought two books, and the French, I think, said that they wanted a sequel. So I wrote, so at that point I was like, right, okay, sequel. Obviously I had ideas, and but I mean, if anyone does read the first book, you'll kind of know what I mean if you get to the end. It was wrapped up in a certain way because I didn't know there would ever be another one. So that was quite difficult, actually, with the sequel. I had to rejig some things, and I'm like retconning, you know? And so I tried to bookend the two so that it would feel complete as a duology at that point. I have a friend who said that they preferred to have written their books in full before they would even consider sending them out there. And I think generally that is quite good advice if you want to publish a trilogy, for example, is to have it as much of it written in advance and planned as you possibly. When this went to, you know, purchasing, it was just that one book. That was all that I'd conceived so far. I hadn't gotten as far as was thinking about a second. So I had to kind of do a lot of the thinking after the fact. And I think it's easier, much easier, if you go in there with this idea of like, okay, if there was a second book, this is what it would be about. And if there was a third book, this is what it would be about. And so I have that situation going on, like in future, hopefully, where I get to plan things before that stage. Yeah, so it was like a blank slate. And the publisher decides at some point whether it's going to do well enough to warrant a sequel. And it's all very nebulous, like the writer is the last person to know that decision.
That makes sense. So how fast did the idea for the second book, correct me if I'm wrong, it's The Boy with the Haunted Heart?
Right.
Go from an idea to here's a finished manuscript.
So it was originally, this is a bit sticky here. So it was originally planned to come out in March 2023.
Okay.
And so writers range from, I wrote this in 2 weeks to I wrote this in 10 years. And I found that too quick. And I needed more time on it. So I probably started writing it after March 2022. And so we're looking at like over 2 years from that point when I started to when it came out. And that was longer than publishing would have liked. But you can sometimes write really quickly, but you're compromised, you know, you're just kind of banging it out. And so it depends. There's a whole thing in publishing about asking for more time because the deadlines tend to be like stricter and stricter. I've noticed, not just me, but like other writers that I know, the deadlines are really harsh sometimes once you're already in that world. And you have to make that call, whether it's good for your health, sanity, mental health, whatever. So I was really struggling at one point and I had to ask for more time. Because, I don't know, some people, they can sit down every day at a computer and they will write the 2,500, 5,000 words, whatever they plan to write without deviation from that. And other writers are like, I can only write when it comes. And so if you're one of those writers, which there are absolutely loads of, it's not this mechanical thing for you where you can guarantee like, oh yeah, I'll have this done in 3 months. You could try, but you might like hit a wall or whatever. So yeah, it's good to have a little bit more time if you can get it. And I always say that you shouldn't feel bad if it takes you a long time to write. Like, people can take decades to write something and it could be absolutely amazing. Like, do not tr like some writers will crack out like 4 books a year, easy, more. Yeah, there's some people out there who are so fast and so efficient in the way they do it. And I respect them, but I am not them. So yeah, so it takes a different amount of time for everyone, but that one was like a little bit delayed because of what I mentioned about the sequel and me wanting to make it feel like when someone read it that it was planned from the beginning rather than, oh, I had to kind of invent this afterwards. Yeah.
I love that. Well, I'm very excited to check out your second book when it comes out. What hook? I'm giving you a 30-second pitch right now. Everybody listening to this, why should we read the first book, The Girl with No Soul, and then The Boy with the Haunted Heart?
Okay, first book. It is literally a book that is about how, as a person, we strive for a feeling of completeness, and our lives are journeys of knowing ourselves and coming to understand ourselves better. So it's about that search for identity, which I feel like almost everyone I've ever met in my life would relate to. And that it's not a straight line, identity and like finding your place in the world is a roundabout treasure hunt for a lot of us, and that's kind of what it is about. But other than that, it is set in a world where the soul can be visible. So there are inspectors who are the government who can literally shine a light, a lantern on your soul and see your darkest secrets and your feelings. And so that is usually pretty enticing of a concept. But on top of that, it's also a romantasy that has a really twisted, multi-layered love story with lots of revelations. And so that brings us to the second book, which is almost like the love interests version of events after the fact. It's a dual POV, and that book is about how we can see the future. And we are distracted by the future to the point of destroying our present, destroying ourselves sometimes. It's about struggling with that shadow within. It's even more of a romancy than the first one. And it is, it's set in a world with a unique magic system that I haven't seen another one quite like it. And it was. I put everything in it in terms of what I was going through emotionally at that time as well. So I like to hope that some of it will be raw and make it to the page. Yeah.
Amazing. Where can we find both these books to be able to purchase? I do have the pre-order link for The Boy with the Haunted Heart below. So if you'd like to pre-order this book, please do. The link will be below. But where can we find your first book?
So we used to be on a lovely site called Book Depository, which would do worldwide shipping, but Book Depository closed down, unfortunately. So it does end up on Amazon, the US Amazon sometimes, which not everyone wants to shop at Amazon, but it's difficult because it's not it's about Scholastic's distribution over in the States. So you can definitely get the Spanish version on the Walmart website. So if you speak Spanish, it's really easy to get that version. It's called La Chica Sin Alma, and it's got the same cover, so it's quite easy to identify. What I would say is if you are struggling to find it online, like a Google will probably bring up some US or Canadian or wherever you are. French, like it's probably on it, and it gets imported to all sorts of places. Like people read it in Malaysia, in Japan, in like the United Arab Emirates. I've like had people reach out to me from really like places I've never been, and they got it out there in English as an import. So generally, you might have to Google for your specific country, but it should be there somewhere. If you are really struggling still, you are welcome to send me a message on my Instagram, which is sailor.crossing, Animal Crossing reference, and I will help you purchase a copy somewhere.
Amazing. I got a couple more questions for you, and we're going to wrap up. So what makes a youth writer, like an author, a youth writer? How do you specifically write when you are gearing to a younger audience?
Some of it is nostalgic in that I am channeling the feeling I had when I read like The Hunger Games, or so it is that sense. I always find like young adult books, they are they have a concept that jumps out at you more. An adult book might take you a longer time to get to the heart of what this book is really about. And I do think that YA is packaged in a way that's easier to get into. It's easier to see the shape of it from the outset. And it has a compulsive readability, which there's a very just like, you know, adult fiction relies on a lot more of the detailing sometimes. I think that YA is this, it's going to grab you from the first chapter, or at least the first three chapters, depending on what kind of YA it is. And also, it's writing with that mindset of the future being yours and the world being yours. To some, like, you're going to inherit this world. That's what I always think about when I start with YA. Like, these young people are going to inherit this shitty, shitty world that I've created here. It's full of injustice and, you know, suffering. And how are they going to feel about it? How is their future going to be limited by that, by the rules of this world? Obviously, it depends. I write dystopia, so that, like, comes easier to me. And yeah, there's this kind of compelling force of change. YA protagonists are more likely to tip tables over, kick doors down, and look for the answers and look for change in that world. Whereas I feel like adult fantasy is more like, oh, we live here, better make the most of it. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of how I look at it. And then the universal emotional things that are true of people of all ages, those are the things that I focus on, like identity, like the search for belonging, found family, you know, like a relationship that's like nurturing, like all of those things that kind of people want, a lot of people want, regardless of their age. But then dial up the emotional intensity a little bit. And that's why I think a lot of adults love YA as well. You jump right into it. It grabs you. It's emotionally visceral, and it plants you right there in the moment, and has a lot of great world building and concepts.
Yeah. Amazing. I love that. You've given a TED Talk worth of advice, a masterclass here of advice. Is there any other piece of advice anybody listening to this that's a keyboard warrior, typing every night and day, trying to get their story out, but they feel like their words are falling to the floor?
Just know that almost every writer feels like that, published or unpublished. Like, there's not this magic thing that happens if you get published where you suddenly have this like confidence, and it's all within you. And like, the number one thing is persistence. Like, so many of the people I'm surrounded with who got published would have never had that if they had given up when they wanted to give up, myself included. If I had given up when I was going to give up, I would not be sitting here talking to you. I don't know where I would be, but yeah, it is that much on a knife edge. Sometimes you are the thing that can possibly, like, yes, this industry is kind of chaotic, it's really hard to get into. You're not in control of all of that, but you are in control of how consistently you keep at it. And it's important, if you can, not to become too isolated in it, where so you have people to read your work and give you feedback and stuff, because that is the things that will keep you going forward. And if you can write a story that has you and your friends kind of squeeing like, oh my god, I can't believe you did that, in your Discord or whatever, you're already a storyteller, you are already a writer, and you should feel confident to call yourself a writer whether you're published or not. That's not like the criteria for being a writer. Like, a writer is someone who is at it every day or as often as they can. There's no, you know, definite schedule, but just someone who has that passion to keep telling stories, even just to themselves. That's cool too. So yeah, keep at it and don't give up. And that probably sounds really cliched, but it is way more important than people understand, because so many writers will drop off on that road, that long road, because it gets really hard sometimes and you think it's never going to be me, it's never going to be me. But it is for a lot of people, and those are the people that kept at it. Like, you never know if you give up, you'll never know what you could have written and how much the world could love it.
Amazing. I mean, the classic saying, you miss every shot you don't take.
Absolutely here. Yep. Like what I said before, I was like, I put this story in the bin. And my agent was like, no, without that person there to do that for me, I'd be in a totally different universe right now. A much sadder universe.
Well, I'm very happy we're in this universe and we get to read your phenomenal work. Now, you are part of the Sims community, which is an amazing community to be a part of. Would you ever consider putting the girl with no soul into a Sims story?
I have some Girl With No Soul content on my Instagram. It's just characters so far, and there is I did like a dollhouse with 5 rooms, one for each part of the soul and the sense that they're associated with. I recently started doing a little story, or tried to do a little story, and it is so incredibly hard. And I kind of shout out all of the Sim story creators in the community, because I am so blown away by the amount of work. Like, I just did 2 episodes so far, and I'm like, oh, the posing, the photography work. It is different to writing a story as well, because I, for example, work in prose. So I'm going to tell you, so and so is walking down the street and here's what they can see. And I'm going to give you a lot of prose. I'm going to kind of give you a lot of unnecessary thoughts that are going through their brain. And that doesn't really work the same way. It's just because I'm a writer doesn't mean that I'll be good at that. I think it's actually like a different art form, a more complicated one. It's kind of like screenwriting, you're like directing, but yeah, the amount of like custom content and the posing and there's so many levels to it. So I now know how much work goes into every single one of those little stories you see on your feed that someone's put together. And it's like mind-blowing, the talent that is in the community. And so, yeah, like, there's definitely some writers out there. You are better than me. And if you keep going at it, you could get published if that's what you really, really want. But I have an appreciation for this as something separate as well, and find it, yeah, it's more work. It's not just the words. It's the pictures. It's everything. It's a really, really impressive skill, and I am enjoying it so much reading all these stories.
Well, Morgan, if you need advice, this is where I can flip the table. As someone who has been doing it for 3 years as a Sims story, 150 chapters out, I have done it all. I have seen it all. I have seen amazing storytellers come and go, and kind of what's out there. This is where I could be like, I can be.
What's your like top 3 pieces of advice for, you know, Sim story writers? Like, what do you think are the most important things?
For me? Okay. So I would say knowing your story, having the full concept through and through, and not stopping a story halfway. I do notice that a lot, as someone who does story spotlights every Saturday for almost the last year and a half. I will get to someone's story spotlight and they will have sent me another email, be like, yeah, I've already canceled the story. And it's really sad because I'll read their interview. I'm like, this is actually really good. I really wish. So it's really sticking to it. You may look at this, like anyone who's reading the square, like, oh, it's like, because I have Grammarly, so it will tell me like the read length per chapter, which is probably about 2 to 3 minutes. Please know that takes about 15 to 20 hours per post to get out. By the time you write it, you build a set if you need to build a set. You got to get your CC, cast, dressing them, the editing, the story, and putting it out there and marketing it. So there's a lot of work there. I would also say, as well, as have fun. Like, the moment you stop having fun, and that's kind of where the moment I'm at right now is, because Instagram doesn't like my story. I'm coming off a 28-day ban because...
Oh my God, a 28-day ban.
28-day ban for 2 people talking in a living room. They deem that is inappropriate. This is my second 28-day ban I've had since I've started this channel. I am also currently shadow banned because Instagram doesn't like what I do, which is really frustrating because I don't do anything different that nobody else does. It's just, yeah. It's just, that's just how my page is seen, unfortunately. And as a social media manager, I do all the tips and tricks to try to, you know, get it unshadow banned, and I'll get to a point and then it goes back to being shadow banned. So I'm planning on taking it offline and going other places with it. But for right now, I'm focusing on this podcast because I want, if I'm going to be putting 15 to 20 hours in per post or per project, I want to make sure that people are listening to it and hearing it, and it doesn't just fall to the wayside. And how you can know if you're shadow banned is I have three accounts. I have my main page, the story page, and the podcast page. I'll just go to my other two pages that are not Rose Chronicles, and I can barely find my story.
It's
frustrating to say the least, but
it's worse than ever lately, I think. Like my engagement is awful, and it just goes up and down just randomly. I can't really understand it, but yeah, I hear what you're saying. You put so much into one episode, like I know, because I did a couple and I was like this is just my first go, and it was so much effort for you. And then I think one of them, it took a few days, but barely anyone was seeing it, and you think, wow, this is creating, isn't it? Like, it's like that with books, it's like that with, sometimes people put so much work into things, and it's all about marketing and that,
right?
Like that's the cynical part of being a creative, is that you have to accept that as the new reality, that it's not just all about, but I mean, I like to think that perseverance will get you past whatever weird shadow banning stuff is going on, because it's got to be an AI that's making this decision. It's not like a conscious human being who understands what they're looking at. So,
well, Instagram deems it as a heavy post because there's 10 slides with words. Anything you add words on Instagram, no bueno. It's not getting seen. Like
you'd think as a platform, you would find a way to encourage this creativity and to encourage more engagement, get people on your platform longer. They spend more money, if that's, you know, assume what Instagram's trying to get us to do, buy stuff that we see on there. Yeah, that's really frustrating. I'm sorry you're going through that.
No, it's okay. Honestly, I made peace with this a long time ago. At this point, I was like, okay, I've taken the side. I've taken the hit. I get it. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to take it down. It's still going to be there. You can read those 150 chapters. I've also used that for pitching devices, being like, here is a cartoon series I would like to pitch. Here's the first 150 out of 220 chapters, which wouldn't actually be 150 because how Instagram works, you have to do, because I do one display photo and then 9 slides that can go with that. So I think Rose Chronicles is actually like 40 chapters said and done completely. But just being like, hey, look at this. I would like to turn this into an anime or a manga or a cartoon. Here's all the work I've done, and I've pitched it, and I get the rejections, and those hurt like hell. But every rejection makes me more motivated to try again.
Yeah. Some important things as well. Okay, so I have written something recently that might be put somewhere or might not, but it's about how storytelling in video games and how I feel like it's actually like an emerging area. Like, obviously, yes, there is storytelling in games and there are like crossovers, but I think this is only going to become more and more popular in the next however many years, because of attention spans and the way we consume media. And so I think like publishing isn't quite caught up to the appeal of that, but they will.
Yes.
And then we'll see that content differently. And the other thing I was going to say to you is graphic novels are having a huge boom at the moment in terms of what's being bought in.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like a creative person who likes to write, if you can team up with someone who likes to draw, that's a really good option for you. And you could start by putting some stuff online. And I know someone who self-published their book and then they got a Scholastic deal for that same book, and Scholastic changed the cover, I believe, and circulated it, and it did really well. So just because you are self-pubbing to begin with, people are making a lot of money from self-publishing. Yes, a lot of people have that traditional dream because it gets you into bookshops. It's different, but that it isn't as clearly divided as it was before. And so if you, if anyone listening to this is having trouble breaking through, like, it is a really valid choice to start with self-pub in any form, and it gives you something that you can market and you can look at, and you can say, look at the continuation here, look at the dedication here, look at the time and effort and so on. So yeah, I think it's really valid to look at self-pub options, and a lot of people self-pubbing are making more money than trad pub, so it's all to play for, and everything's changing, so you know, the market will change too.
Makes total sense. Well, Morgan, thank you so much for coming here today and indulging my interview of being like, I'm literally like, I've taken everything you said. I'm like, needs to do this afternoon. Well, thank you so much for coming here and sharing your wisdom of, you know, how to become a published author. I know a lot of us in the community do dream to one day hold our book in our hand, either being self-published or published. So thank you for sharing your wisdom and tricks. Where can we find you? Like, where can, like, this is your self-plugging time. Go nuts.
I'm not on all of the platforms. I am only on Instagram regularly, which is sailor.crossing. I used to tell stories in Animal Crossing. If you scroll far enough back, you'll find those stories. But you are welcome, anyone listening to this, to send me a DM. If I can help you with any advice about writing, then I will. I don't see myself as different or special or better of a writer than anyone in the community. I really do believe that a lot of publishing is being in the right time and place and having the right idea. So I want to encourage anyone like that. Like, these are achievable goals for people. And yeah, you can DM me there. I am on Twitter, X, as Morgan Owen YA. I have a TikTok account that I do not use, which is the same handle. TikTok kind of scares me, but I've got to get down with that at some point. Yeah, that's all. That's the only place that I am. I like to have a minimalist online presence.
I love that. Also, who gives a fuck about TikTok? It's probably getting banned in the States anyways. Love you all, my US listeners, but TikTok's got to go.
Sensory overload for me.
Yes, I have ADHD, and I've recently fallen down that trap with reels. I couldn't even imagine TikTok. Yeah. And also, TikTok's a really toxic, negative place. So I'm not sad to see that go in the States, even though I'm not American, I'm Canadian, and we would still have it. So
you could be like, I mean, if the US doesn't have it, there's no point. Yeah, I'm sure there are probably parts of TikTok that are delightful. It's kind of like Threads. I keep getting recommended Threads, but they're always like really like toxic book fights about, oh, you shouldn't review like this, or you shouldn't read like this, or you shouldn't turn your corners over on your books. And I'm just like, nobody cares. Do what you like, have fun, be nice to each other. There's no need for all of this drama at all.
I could not agree more. Well, Morgan, thank you so much for coming here today. Please, 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 if you'd like to pre-order, The Boy with the Haunted Heart, the link is going to be below. If you would like to purchase The Girl with No Soul, I did find a link for the UK. So I was like, is there a Canadian link? Is there an international link that I can put this in? Because I only found the UK.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. I can have a little look and I will put it in my stories. It might be that there's not anything now, but will be when this, it didn't, it, yeah, I'm not going to get into distribution. It's a whole labyrinth of confusion. But it does pop up on something because my American friend ordered it from somewhere. I think it was on Amazon. I will see what I can do and I'll update my link tree, which is linked in my bio.
Amazing. Well, please go check, please go support our friend Morgan here. Thank you so much for coming here today and indulging me and answering all these questions. It has been an absolute pleasure getting to know you. Have a great rest of your day. Bye.
Bye. Bye.